Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services ADAPT Supervisor Jennifer Perkins and Mary Wall, Adult Protective Services Supervisor in the Adult and Aging Division of the Department of Family Services, to talk about family violence, specifically family violence homicides. Jen, Mary, welcome to Unscripted and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we start, I want to let our listeners know if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. When actor-director Rob Reiner and his producer wife Michelle were found stabbed to death, they certainly weren't the first victims to lose their lives to alleged family violence, but they are perhaps the most famous in the last decade. I say not the first because, in fact, Fairfax County and the surrounding jurisdictions have seen their fair share of family violence homicides of late. But perhaps the celebrity factor of the Reiner murders can help us shed more light on this particular form of interpersonal violence. I have to start with a disclaimer. Rob and Michelle's oldest son stands accused of their murders, crimes for which he has pleaded not guilty. So we will refer to their deaths by family homicide as alleged. What is family violence? Mary, I'm going to send this question to you.
With Adult Protective Services, we do see a fair amount of family violence. How we interpret that definition is it's just like abusive behavior, coercion within a family. It can be intimate partner, but typically we can see it with extended family, children, spouses, cousins, aunts, anything.
So, Jen, how is family violence different from domestic violence?
So if you were to Google the word domestic, it is a household, anything related to family. Traditionally, we think of domestic violence as intimate partner violence, so violence between a romantic relationship. However, family violence and domestic violence go hand in hand. Family violence is a type of domestic violence. So if you are violent towards your family member and you are arrested, at least in the state of Virginia, you are going to get charged with domestic violence, or more specifically, assault and battery of a household member. However, it is possible that you and your family member don't reside in the same household. It would still be considered domestic violence. So if you were to do a search, a lot of times family violence, it'll say family violence and domestic violence, and they're grouped together as one and the same. And then other sites will refer to domestic violence as intimate partner violence, that romantic relationship violence. But family violence and domestic violence really do go hand in hand. So it's really a matter of linguistics.
Okay. So what are some signs of family violence? What should the people around look for? What are things that would say, hey, there's something going on in this family?
Sure. And that would be similar with domestic violence. So I'm going to use these words maybe interchangeably. But I know for the sake of this show, we're not as focused on intimate partner violence. So it's going to be very similar. I mean, there's the obvious signs of physical injury that are otherwise not explained. But there could be other signs where somebody, you notice that there's changes in behavior. Maybe the individual is isolating. Maybe they're not engaged in social activities as much as they used to be. Maybe they just seem off. Something's different. They're staying home more. They feel more anxious to be home or respond to messages. They might not be sharing as much. There's just something that is, you're just noticing a difference, a behavioral change. I know with the Reiner family, people who were seeing them out and about prior to their deaths, noticed that Nick Rayner wasn't as friendly as he normally was. He wasn't as talkative, that they just sensed a tension amongst the family. The parents had shared with some of their closest friends concerns about their son and his well-being. So sometimes it can be really obvious things, obvious signs, and families sometimes will share, but sometimes they won't. There's still a lot of shame and stigma attached to all of these things, family violence, mental health, substance use. And so sometimes people will be secretive about it, but sometimes they're talking about it too. As in this case, there were moments where the Rayner family was sharing with their closest circle their concerns that they were having for their son. I think that sometimes when a situation has been going on for so long, nobody thinks of the worst case scenario that could happen. And they see that as an overreaction. So it's like, okay, well, he's struggling. Nick Rayner's struggling, but he's been struggling since he was 15. What else is new?
Okay, we're going to pause on that front for a moment. Mary, what do you guys look for in adult protective services? What are some signs that say something's going on, something's wrong?
I think what's tricky, and the same things that Jennifer mentioned, the difference with us sometimes is they can be confused with dementia. They can be confused with normal aging. Like, hey, this person isn't going out to their favorite coffee spot as much because mobility-wise, they're not able to, or they're not able to drive. So that isolation piece, they're confused with their finances or different, like the line is a bit blurred about what is this person's actual functioning status or what is them being exploited or abused. So I think that's a bit difficult. And that's also what makes them such vulnerable victims to this of, you know, they are confused. They are having some mobility challenges. And then that is a perfect opportunity for different people or family members to then take advantage of that. So I think, yeah, you're looking for behavioral changes and you're looking for it to not be in congruence of, hey, they aren't driving because they just had eye surgery, or they're not driving because their daughter took their car, ? Trying to figure out, like, does it match the story of what is that congruency of, is, does this fit the story that's being told? Is that fair to make that assumption? Mm-hmm. I think the other thing too is with mandated reporters, you don't have to have the answers. You just have to have suspicion. And that's our jobs to go in and do that full investigation. So even if you're worried about something or you have some suspicion, you can always call it in. And then that's where we will come in and do a full investigation.
Okay, you mentioned mandated reporters. What is a mandated reporter?
Yes. So mandated reporters are professionals. So that can be teachers, nurses, therapists, just a range of people. Clergy members are now mandated reporters, meaning that if they have a suspicion of abuse, neglect, or exploitation, either for children or adults, they are mandated by law to call in to the Adult Protective Services or Child Protective Services hotline to make a report of abuse, neglect, or exploitation. Again, they don't have to do the investigating themselves. They don't have to know all the details. They just have to have a worry, concern, or suspicion. And hopefully, you know, some relevant information or details that can help make the report valid. It's very difficult when we get reports that we don't have identifying information. We have to have a living identifiable adult, or in our case, an adult who lives in this jurisdiction. So if you don't know their address or you don't know their name, and we have great intake workers who do really good due diligence, but sometimes we're not able to validate a report if we don't have substantial information.
Okay. And now I'm going to circle back to you, Jen. You mentioned substance abuse. What part do substance misuse or mental health issues play in this type of family violence, but also in family violence homicides? I couldn't find recent statistics, but what I was able to dig up suggested that a lot, if not the majority, of family violence homicides involve either substance misuse, mental health issues, or both.
Yes, that is correct. And so they often do play a role. I also can't confirm any sort of statistics on this. What we do know is that if there is somebody who has a history of engaging in any level of violence and they have an untreated substance use disorder and mental health condition, we call that co-occurring disorders in the mental health professional world, that they are 8 times more likely to engage in violence in the future, and that it is a significant risk factor for domestic violence homicide. So those are really significant factors. We know that if Nick Rayner, we know that he hasn't been found guilty yet, but if he were to be found guilty, that was a significant role in that story, that played a significant role. In terms of looking at some of the other more famous family violence homicides, we also know that things like trauma play a big role. We have some other famous cases happened significantly longer ago, but the Menendez brothers, they had said that they were being victims by their parents, sexual abuse was going on, and that was what they saw as their way out. We have the Gypsy Rose story. I don't know if you all are familiar with that story. She was dating a guy who she got to unalive her mother, who was being abusive to her. And that was her way out of the abuse. So there's so many different stories. It does seem that sometimes co-occurring disorders, again, that's a substance use disorder and mental health play a role. Sometimes it's trauma. Sometimes we also have famous cases where somebody unalives their children and they were in the midst of postpartum psychosis. So it is very common that you see mental health and or substance use disorders playing a role in this. We do know that those who are diagnosed with a serious mental health condition are not more likely than the general population to engage in violent behaviors. However, you combine that with substance use, then the risk does go up.
That's not a mitigating factor, though, is it? Or is it? So if we bring this to trial, if you're found guilty, are you less guilty? Is your sentence a little bit less because you had a mental health issue or because you were abusing substances? Or is it across the board, you did it, you go to jail?
Well, we know that not everybody who has substance use and mental health issues go on to murder family members. So we know it's a little bit more than that. It's a little bit more nuanced and complicated than that. And that is different than, say, a not guilty by reason of insanity plea, in which mm-hmm. you have to be found that at the time that you committed the crime, that you were not aware of what you were doing was wrong at that moment. My understanding is that's going to be the approach in the Nick Rayner case. And I've heard a lot of debate on that because of some of his behaviors to suggest that he did know what he did was wrong after the fact. But again, he hasn't gone to trial yet, so can't speak to that. But I've worked with people who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity in a previous job and role and got ordered to state hospital. Andrea Yates is a famous case of somebody who unalived her children and got found not guilty by reason of insanity. Because it was determined at the moment that she unalived her children, she was in the throes of psychosis and thought she was saving them from an evil spirit or the devil. I forget the specifics. So that is very different from somebody having a mental health and substance use disorder, because there are people who have those issues but are very much aware at the time that what they're doing is wrong. And they still do it anyway. And again, not everybody who has mental health and substance use problems goes on to harm people that they love or even strangers for that matter.
What about access to weapons? Does this increase the risk of family violence? I know within intimate partner violence, it's an issue, particularly access to guns. Is it the same for family violence?
I would say for guns, yes. However, we're seeing a lot of these cases of family violence, like non-intimate partner homicides that are stabbings, which is a lot more of an intimate way to unalive somebody. We just had a case in Fairfax County with a man who murdered his entire family with a machete. And the police ended up killing him because they were doing that to save one of his victims who was, I believe, still in critical condition in the hospital. And we don't know, because this man was killed, we don't know what the motive was. We don't know what was going on with him, that he murdered his wife and he murdered his daughter and almost his son-in-law with a large, sharp object. So this was not firearm. Just like the Nick Rainer, the Rainers were not killed with a firearm. It was another stabbing. So I'd be curious to hear more about that. I know that stabbings are a far more intimate way to unalive somebody than a firearm is. And we do know firearm increases risk. We did have a case in my neighborhood in Fairfax County. And I'd be curious of what Mary has to say about this topic, because it was an 87-year-old man who shot and killed his 86-year-old wife over an argument going to a nursing home. And I don't know, Mary, if you see a lot more of those concerns and cases in your work working with adults and aging. But I imagine that's a risk factor for older folks as well.
Having access to weapons in the home for us is also compounded by the fact of like dementia or confusion. And there are, you know, red flag laws, and we do work with the Fairfax County Police very closely on some of those cases. And it's such a balance because, you know, we want to respect people's autonomy and rights while also making sure that they're safe or those around them are safe. It's also such a difficult balance with family members of figuring out when is the appropriate time to take away weapons, how to do it. And, you know, a lot of family members grapple with that, of like, especially with when roles are like, hey, this is my mom or this is my dad. I'm respecting their authority. I'm not supposed to be doing this. So, I mean, but that's, you know, the layers of family violence too, is that this is somebody who I know and love and have a close relationship with, and figuring out, you know, where is the line, what is safe, especially if that's been your pattern throughout your relationship with that person. And then now all of a sudden, they are exhibiting different signs, or the relationship has shifted. It takes a bit, it's a bit easier for us on the outside to see something, versus when they're in it, they're like, oh no, that's just always been our relationship. It's hard for them to see a line, much easier for us. And at the same time, we have to respect their choices and their life, and offer what we can in support. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things about adult protective services is, yes, we go in and yes, we investigate all these things. And if the person has capacity to make their own decisions, all we can do is support them and offer resources, and whenever they're ready, be there for them. But ultimately, we have to respect their decisions.
Okay, Mary, what you just said brought up two questions for me, but I'm going to pause before we go to those to take a quick break to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. So back to the dementia question. If someone has dementia and it's been diagnosed and the whole nine, and they harm their partner, can that be considered family violence? Because they actually have this disease that they don't even sometimes remember who they're hurting.
Yeah, we have a lot of cases like that, where they, I mean, They're not aware. They're confused or they're scared, right? They wake up in the middle of the night and they're like, who is in my house? And yes, we consider that because there was still harm done.
Mm-hmm.
We're making a finding. However, we understand the layer and yes, our job is to investigate things, but it's also to support. So while we may make a finding and we do consider that to meet criteria for a level of family violence, we are not, we're doing our best to find avenues and routes of how can we support this? How can we prevent this? How can we make sure that, you know, everyone has their needs met in some capacity?
And you've mentioned a couple of times autonomy and people's levels of independence and people not reporting. And why is this crime so underreported?
I mean, these are the most vulnerable people. So when they maybe they don't have the social networking for people to recognize these signs and report on their behalf.
Uh-huh.
They themselves don't know that this is reaching a level. And this is what we see a lot, they recognize that it's happening. They recognize that it's not something that they want. However, their relationship we've had so many cases where it's like, oh, I can't put my granddaughter out on the street because then she'll be homeless. And that's valid. They have a relationship and they clearly love each other. And so there's a lot of guilt knowing that, hey, I was the one that, you know, made my granddaughter homeless or, you know, made my nephew go to jail.
Jen, we see a lot of this in intimate partner violence as well, don't we? Where somebody is not wanting to report because they don't want the spouse to lose their job or they don't want, you know, the partner to suffer any bad harm. They just want the abuse to stop.
Yes. Yeah. And it's very common for all the reasons Mary mentioned. If there is financial dependence on that person, then there's that concern and fear if this person gets incarcerated or, you know, what's going to happen to me and my financial security. There's which we see a lot in, especially intimate partner violence, the gaslighting, feeling like you're at fault, that maybe you're blowing this up out of proportion. And so maybe it's an overreaction to call the police. And frankly, there's a lot of people out there who just are scared of the police, especially right now, and do not want the police in their homes and are worried about that. So there's a lot of reasons why people don't report when these things happen.
It seems like there's been a spate of family violence in Fairfax County in particular in recent weeks. Is that true? Has there been a spike or has it always been like this? But because there was a celebrity death just a few months ago, it's top of mind for people.
I am not native to this area, but I've been in Virginia since 2000. So I've been here a while now. And I've been in Fairfax County for a while now, many of those years. And I think there's been, from what I can see, a spike not only in family violence and the homicides lately, but all types of violence. We've had stranger violence, just spikes in violence everywhere. And typically we see spikes in violence when we see spikes in unemployment rates, when we see spikes in cost of living, and all those other things tend to coincide with spikes in violence. So I know for me, just my experience living in this area a while now, I can't speak to research or statistics, just the overall, from what I've seen, just my observations, it does seem like there's been more violence reported lately. In terms of just violence all around.
I will say for us in Fairfax County with adults, the population is aging,
mm-hmm.
and continuing to. And we have a large portion of Fairfax County that is 65 and older, and then each year that increases.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are just trending upwards continually simply for the fact that people are aging.
Okay. Hadn't thought about that. Thanks, Mary. Can we prevent family violence and in turn family violence homicides?
We absolutely can. I mean, the reality is we're not going to prevent all of them. Look at the Reiner family. They had their access to the best treatment out there, the best services. They were super wealthy, had family support, and this still happened to them. So that just goes to show that no matter how much money you have, how much support you have, that you're not immune from these things. So these things are still going to happen. We can learn from these, each and every one of these. And we do, and we try to. Professionals will gather and try to say, like, especially those who are involved with that family, I'm sure at some point, I can guarantee all the professionals involved in supporting that family are saying, what could we have done different? Right. And so we could absolutely learn from all of these, situations, awful tragedies. And learn how to prevent these things from happening again. I think it's a fine line and something a lot of families struggle with in terms of how do I support my loved one who's struggling without enabling? And it is very, very tricky. It's a lot easier for us on the outside to judge those families and say, well, they should have done this or they should have done that. But until you're going through it yourself, It's very hard to gauge at one point am I enabling and what point am I being supportive and where's the balance between that? And so I say that for anybody who is experiencing this in their family and they have concerns to reach out for help. And that's super important. There is a lot of support out there for those who have a loved one who's struggling, whether it's an aging parent, whether it's an adult child who has a co-occurring disorder. Again, that's a combination of a substance use mental health disorder, or just one or the other. If you have somebody in your home who has a significant addiction issue or significant mental health issue, please get yourself some help. I think where some families go wrong is that they end up making it an individual issue and not a family issue, that this person's maybe a difficult family member, they might be considered the bad seed and they're the one that needs to get help. But really, everybody needs to get help in terms of how do I be in a loving relationship with this partner, child, sibling, whatever your relationship is, how do I support them in a way that is not contributing to the problem? That is something that is really unrealistic to figure out on your own. You need professional help with that.
And so can you give us some examples of some professional help, some numbers to call, some organizations to reach out to?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one, I would say if you are a resource family and you have privilege and resources and all those things, and you have access to a certain level of treatment for your family member, loved one, ask those providers as to what sort of supports and help you can get. A lot of programs and rehabilitation centers have family groups and therapists that do family work with family members. For the majority of other folks who don't have access to that level of resources, there's certain really great organizations that provide support and hotline numbers for individuals who are experiencing themselves and or caregivers. And I will share two with you, or actually I'll share three. If it's an addiction issue, you can always go to Al-Anon or an Ar-Anon meeting. That's like you've heard of AA, NA maybe, 12-step meetings. These are free support meetings. They offer them online or in person all throughout the country. They have ones for family members of loved ones suffering from addiction as well. Mm-hmm. Al-Anon is probably the one that is that people are most familiar with. There's a Nar-Anon as well. So that's Narcotics Anonymous, or Al-Anon is for those who have loved ones who have alcohol dependency issues. But there's also SAMHSA, which stands for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. And they have a hotline number. They also have resources on their website as well for family members and caregivers. But they also have a hotline. It's 1-800-662-6222. 1-800-662-HELP or 1-800-662-4357. And the other popular organization that does a lot of advocacy and support for those experiencing mental health issues and or caregivers of those struggling with these illnesses is called NAMI, which stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness. And their hotline number is 1-800-950-NAMI, which is NAMI, or 1-800-950-6264. And they also have a lot of information and support for caregivers on their website as well.
And Mary, what about Adult Protective Services?
Yes. So our Adult Protective Services hotline, 8 to 4:30, you're going to get a live social worker with Fairfax County. Mm-hmm. After 4:30, you still call the same number and it switches over to the state, and the state will take the report and give it to us. So one way or another, you can use this number. It's 703-324-7450.
And we're going to repeat the domestic and sexual violence 24-hour hotline. It's 703-360-7273. What are your last final thoughts? What do you want people listening to take away from this conversation? Oh, this is for both of you.
I think when we're talking about family violence in the context of adult protective services, roles change. So the parent that you were for a younger child may be different than the parent that you are to an adult mm-hmm. child, to if you're an adult now taking care of a parent, to like these roles all change and they're fluid. And with that change, there may be confusion in how to figure it out with these different factors of substance abuse and mental illness and financial exploitation. And it's not just you, everybody, every single person experiences that shift in the roles. And so it's totally fair to not know how to navigate it or need some help in figuring out. So there's no shame in calling just the intake and getting resources, figuring something out. This affects every single person, regardless of everyone's roles change as we age.
Yeah, and I will just repeat what I had mentioned earlier, that even if you're one of the wealthiest humans on the planet and are a Hollywood star and have access to all the resources you could ever imagine and hope for, doesn't mean that you're immune from these issues. And to get help, that there's help out there, that's really important. Even when things are going well, to have support, this stuff is hard. It's hard whether you are a caregiver for an aging parent or you have somebody struggling with significant mental health and or substance use issues in your home or addiction issues. This stuff is really, really, really hard. And there's help out there and there's no shame in asking for help.
Okay. Good note to end it on. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Jen and Mary for joining us and sharing their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.